First, the United States is a country founded in many respects on ideas. But defining big concepts like equality, liberty, self-interest, freedom, and America's place in the world has always been a messy process. That ongoing conversation has given life in many ways to our culture and politics over the last few centuries. It's also the basis for the field of intellectual history, which our next guest says is a way to eavesdrop on the past. Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is a professor of history at UW-Madison and author of several books. Her latest is The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, why tackle the study of history through the lens of ideas?
Spending now my life doing this, I can't imagine any other way of wanting to do it. There are a couple of reasons. One is why most people, I think, are drawn to history is because they're drawn to thinking about how people in the past made sense of themselves, you know, how they made a life for themselves, how they made a world for themselves. And what better way to do that to then, as I say in the book, you know, eavesdrop on how they think about themselves, how they think about their world, how they think about the major problems of the day. So I think it's a way of kind of closing up the distance between us and people in the past and being in a conversation with them.
And speaking of conversation, I hope you don't mind me spoiling the last line of your book.
Uh-oh.
And so the conversation of American thought continues. And that seems like a running theme. It's not just these isolated parade of ideas. It's ideas that cross national boundaries, that cross the boundaries of decades, too. These things keep interacting in new and unexpected ways.
I'm glad you picked up on that last line. The last line of a book is always a hard one, right? Because mm-hmm. you want to stick the landing. And it's funny that you pick up on that because the book was provisionally called American Conversations. I think to make the point that American intellectual history, you know, you can talk about it as a tradition, but that makes it sound so formal, so complete, you know, as if it's this artifact that gets handed down from one generation to the next. But that's not how ideas work. That's not how history works. It is an ongoing conversation. People across time, across the expanses, you know, of history, across places, and then, of course, across national boundaries, sometimes linguistic boundaries. And so that is the approach of the book, and I think the approach of intellectual history more broadly is to see how Americans have talked with each other and past each other and sometimes shouted at each other about the things that were most important to them.
And another theme that I think runs through the book is the people who weren't part of the conversation or who were omitted from the conversation sometimes but were unmistakable parts of it still, from the early interactions of Europeans and Native Americans, from slaves in America, women throughout the history you look at. They weren't not there, but in some ways they were ignored in the main, what we think back on in the main intellectual conversation. Can you talk about the role and the importance of looking at their voices too?
Thank you for noticing that. That was a challenge of the book. It's a challenge of intellectual history in general, because typically intellectual historians look at, you know, sources like books, magazine articles, newspapers, broadsides, sermons. And for much of American history, who got to go on record, of course, were white men, propertied men, which meant that people of different backgrounds, women, weren't as easily, you know, traceable on the record. So that is always the challenge of the intellectual historian, is to widen out from those traditional sources to try to listen to the mental, you know, the records of the mental and moral worlds of others. So that was a challenge to do, but they're there. You know, you have people like Judith Sargent Murray, who's an important Revolutionary era thinker, someone like a Frederick Douglass, who was, you know, one of the most important orators of the 19th century. So the records are there. We just have to look for them.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen from UW-Madison. Her new book is The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. I want to take a whirlwind tour. You cover a lot of ground in the book. Let's start with the first contact between Europeans and Native Americans. As you write about it, and I haven't really thought about it this way, just the existence of Native Americans on this continent led to a lot of reflection about who the Europeans were and the European mm-hmm. settlers in America and how they all fit into the world and the history of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something easy to forget, and partly because the lore that we've inherited through our history, but frankly some of these European settlers had, which was of a vast open continent, you know, an Eden, or in some cases, a place forsaken by God, where there was not strong enough recognition that there was, in fact, a native populations here and in the hundreds of millions. So for the first 100 years, at least, European settlers and explorers are dwarfed by the Native American population here. And so that's an example, Rob, where you ask me, where do you listen? How do you listen for those silences? Even if we are listening into, you know, Puritan era sermons and Native Americans are not mentioned, we as historians know they were there. You know, they were there, right there in the same towns, right on the outskirts. And so kind of looking for the presence of what seem like absences are presences throughout. And so this is any look at early American thought, we have to listen in. Sometimes it's articulated and sometimes it's muffled about what it meant to be a displaced person, you know, whether it was from Germany or France or from the British, somewhere in the British Empire, or even Spain or Portugal, to be landed here on this new continent surrounded by, you know, all enormous a number of people with a different tongue, different ways, you know, different cultures, and to feel that sense of alienation and estrangement that came as a result of that.
Moving ahead to another challenge, with the revolution predicated on ideas of freedom and liberty and self-determination and equality, and then the contradiction of slavery going on, as you write, actually not just out there, but right at the universities where people were thinking about these things and having to come up with the intellectual framework. And that led some people to abolitionism, saying if we want to be consistent, we have to end slavery. Others saying, no, we're not equal. Here's how we justify this inequality.
Yeah. No, thank you for putting it that way. That's very helpful. And I think something that I tried to do in the book, it's not always easy, but that is, I think there's a temptation for Americans when they think about their past to sort of think about it as a split screen. You know, the North is free and the South, you know, is a slave, or, you know, we've got freedom over here and we've got, you know, some sort of bondage or slavery. And actually the two they're not mutually exclusive. They happen in the same spaces. So you mentioned, you know, early American universities. That is something I talk about in the book. Every single early American university is founded on dispossessed land, you know, lands that's dispossessed from Native Americans. Every single American university, in one form or another, has slaves who are building the actual buildings, literally the foundations. Harvard University, it used to be one of the bonuses of becoming the president of Harvard. You had your own personal slave there. We've got examples of students bringing their slaves to school with them. And so right there at the sites of learning, yeah, where they're learning, in some cases, the great ideas of the Enlightenment, which is freedom, self-rule, self-determination, is happening in the context, you know, on dispossessed lands in the presence of people who are there in bondage. And many, I would even say a vast majority of these folks are not noticing the dissonance, you know, of those two things. So that's something that I try to focus on the book, not look at slavery and freedom as separate, but how do they work together? I'll give you another example. Thomas Jefferson, one of our most important thinkers about freedom. You know, we can't think about American freedom without thinking about Jefferson, who over the course of his lifetime owned 600 people and had 5 children with his slave. These are not, you have to hold it together, you know, that he's writing Peons to Liberty while he has an army of slaves serving him. It doesn't discount the work. It doesn't delegitimize it. It just complicates it.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue the conversation with UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen about her new book, The Ideas That Made America. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Which ideas or thinkers do you think have had the biggest impact on America, for better or for worse? Have you seen ideas about things like equality, self-interest, or religion change, even in the course of your own lifetime? And are there ideas that you're curious to learn more about? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer, reading through your book, one idea that came back to me, and I remember from high school, and I realized almost nothing about it, transcendentalism. This is one of those things that people point to as a key, fundamental American, uniquely American in some ways, school of thought. Mm-hmm. Remind us what that is.
Perhaps it's easy to forget or want to forget because of its unlovely name, Transcendentalism. Even the Transcendentalists didn't want to be called Transcendentalists. So there's a funny, you know, internal dialogue among Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller and others who just thought this was sort of clunky and silly. So the Transcendentalists, for those of your listeners who also have a vague recollection from high school of like, we're typically referring to a group of liberal, very literary intellectuals, mostly around the Boston area in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, where many of them, and I mean, you know, well, the names are Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau was considered in this orbit, pardon me, Herman Melville, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously the biggie is Ralph Waldo Emerson. And they're a group of friends, sometimes frenemies. Some of them are liberal Protestant ministers. Other of them are apostates like an Emerson. But they're all committed to a kind of intellectual project and are working on it together. And that is basically, it comes down to a couple of things. First of all, what the Transcendentalists share is a sense that that Americans had achieved their political independence from the old world, but not necessarily an intellectual or a cultural independence. And so what we see with Emerson, and you know, we know it's the self-reliance, right? His big idea of self-reliance and others was the idea of what would it be like to start an intellectual culture, you know, a set of ideas, a kind of literature that was genuinely organic to our democratic project, genuinely organic to this new world, and not something that we're just inheriting, you know, sort of secondhand from Europe. The second part of it is that the what makes the Transcendentalists is that they understood that democracy is more than just a political organization, you know, or institution. Democracy would have to also reflect the whole human personality, or in their words, the human soul. So what they're committed to through poetry, through writing, through sermons, through utopias like Brook Farm, was the idea of actually cultivating a democratic personality, a democratic soul.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yes, thank you. This is a fascinating topic, something I've been interested in for many years. I ran for political office in 2008, and in my process of running for the Wisconsin State Legislature, I had a dream about Benjamin Franklin. And I know it's going to sound silly, but I've had a number of dreams in my life about my ancestors and stuff. Well, he came to me and he told me that Barack Obama was going to be the next president and that this was a great moment for our country. And I asked him, I said, oh, really, why? And he said what you just said about the idea that democracy is a reflection of your soul and philosophy and mm-hmm. community and those kinds of philosophical, mystical aspects of society are really a reflection of oneself.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Does his dream version of Ben Franklin match up to the reality?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you, Jeff. I want to thank you for your service. And second of all, I hope that all of our representatives are as intellectually curious and engaged as you are and also have a space for imagination or what you're calling your dreams. Because to be honest, I think the most magical moments in American history have come when people's dreams of what America could be outshot the reality. One thing I would say to Jeff is that there is a specific history in American political thought about dreams and dreaming. You know, the American dream as an idea. Martin Luther King, I have a dream. Obama, dreams for my father. There are no other political politics that I'm aware of, it's certainly not in the Western world, where the language of dreams and dreaming figure so close into our political discourse. And I think that is precisely as what you're touching on, is the sense that there's something larger. What, you know, living a truly democratic life, building a truly democratic society is something that needs to is created through imagination, but also needs to leave some space for that imagination. So I hope that Franklin comes back to you again. He's a good person to visit.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about her new book, The Ideas That Made America. I want to come to a more modern era now. We hear a lot in the political world about the rise of what people call identity politics, politics based on, say, race, gender, sexuality, things like that. And it's presented as a new thing. Mm-hmm. But looking back at the 19th century, I wonder, is it really so new?
I don't want to say it's old wine in new bottles, but it's just a new term for a long-standing, if you will, debate or concern in American life. And I would say, I mean, you mentioned the founding, even before the founding, when Europeans arrive in this continent, what do they have in common? Nothing. I mean, you know, there are people from Europe who came from different tongues, different religious groups, different classes.
They might well have killed each other if they're in the wrong
country
in Europe.
Exactly. Absolutely. And so what happens already, you know, right from the outset in this American experiment is people trying to figure out what is the we. You know, what holds us together as Americans when we have different faiths and we have different tongues? And so the idea of difference, diversity, questions of inclusion have been there right from the start. And we've addressed these questions differently. We've allowed, you know, some people in and some people out over time. We've redistricted, if you will, the we. But that question about how do we live as one, you know, where do we find our unum out of our pluribus has been with us throughout American history. And identity politics is important and significant, but it's another term for a longstanding problem and possibility, if you will, in a pluralistic America.
I also want to talk about, and coming back to an idea we talked about earlier, the way ideas flow from one place to another. You give an example, I think it's an introduction about some of the things that inspired Martin Luther King. There's the Old Testament, but there's also Gandhi. Can you talk about the international flow of ideas that might lead to a pivotal thinker like Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, that's something, you mentioned it's a brief book, so there's a lot of compression, but that is something I wanted to signal to my readers whenever I had the chance to, which is sometimes we think of ideas as American, but in fact they have foreign origins, or they crisscross across the globe to become what they are. So the backstory of a Martin Luther King. I mean, this isn't to minimize him. He's singular. He's an irrepeatable miracle in many ways. But Martin Luther King is getting many of his ideas from Gandhi. And Gandhi was an avid reader of Henry David Thoreau and civil disobedience. And so that's just one example of the kind of curious crossings, you know, both across space, so geographical crossings, as well as across, you know, expanses of human history that make for what we call this American intellectual tradition or American conversation.
Well, when I think about genius or a great thinker, it isn't necessarily someone who, I don't know how you would come up with ideas out of whole cloth, but it's somebody who takes what's out there and maybe reinvents them, reframes them for the current time.
This you are channeling your inner Ralph Waldo Emerson, because this is precisely Emerson's point about the great genius is actually the most creative reader. So Emerson understood. Emerson is someone who was very, you know, interested in, again, not being derivative, not being secondhand, being his own Adam in history, you know, the first man at history, but understanding that there are intellectual influences coming to him. And so genius, I think, as it's expressed itself in America, is often taking something already there in the Bible, from the Constitution, from Benjamin Franklin, and doing something new with it, you know, making, reworking it for one's own moment, you know, seeing new possibilities in it. I think a great example, if I may just tuck one in here, is the Declaration of the Sentiment of Rights of Women, 1848. It's modeled on the Declaration of Independence, a time when it was considered, you know, that women could not be free and equal in the way that men could. But in 1848, what do you have but a group of women rewriting the Declaration to declare the independence of women?
In our last minute or so, kind of bringing things home, it seems like another reason to study the history of ideas is these ideas, they're the water we're kind of swimming in, mm-hmm. and it's worth it to maybe take these things that we just take for granted and look at the time and place they rose in.
You could not have given a better bumper sticker for intellectual history. And this is something I try to talk about in the book. And if there's one thing I hope that readers take away, it's the one thing I hope my students take away is this, that every single conversation we have today, every debate, every conflict, intellectual conflict, everything that we agree on is not necessarily a product of necessity, or, you know, this is not all foreordained. It's a product of history. There's no conversation we're having right now that hasn't in some form or another been wrestled through, struggled through, debated through, you know, in the 1950s, in the 1900s, in the 1850s and earlier. And so to me, that's the great, you know, reward of intellectual history, is that as we wrestle with our post-truth moment, you know, our moment about identity politics, our moment about what's, you know, the state of our very fractured democracy, we can bring ourselves into conversation with some great thinkers and great writers and great advocates and activists from the past who have engaged those same problems in their own time. And sometimes they can help us figure some solutions, but sometimes they just keep us company too. You know, there's a sense of you're part of something larger than yourself. Or we are at this moment because we're going through what many of our forefathers and foremothers have gone through in different form.
We'll leave it there. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, professor of history at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about her new book, The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the latest developments in the effort to develop hormonal birth control for men. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The sporting world has essentially come to a grinding halt because of the COVID-19 outbreak. We'll get the latest on when play might resume and what's going on in Wisconsin. In the meantime, that's coming up. First, facing budget challenges, hospitals have looked to the manufacturing sector for ideas on how to improve their employees' productivity and efficiency. That's according to a recent Wisconsin Watch report done in collaboration with Wisconsin Public Radio and Madison's Cap Times. The reporters found that implementing what's called a lean staffing model had some negative impact, though, on workload for nurses and raised some concerns about the quality of patient care. Parker Shore is a public affairs reporting fellow for the Cap Times and embedded with Wisconsin Watch. And Bram Sable-Smith is WPR's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow, also with Wisconsin Watch. Parker, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Bram, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Before we get into specific hospitals, this is a story triggered by, it sounds like, a trend. Bram, could you tell us about this lean concept as applied to hospitals?
Yeah, so lean, it's a manufacturing model that comes from Toyota. And really, lean is kind of a stand-in for the embracing of the healthcare industry of these kind of manufacturing models that focus on, one, eliminating waste, and two, maximizing productivity. So in the cases of nursing staffing, which is what we're looking at, we're talking about, you know, if we're eliminating waste, maybe that means a nurse with too much downtime. And when we're talking about productivity, it's almost, I kind of think about it like Moneyball in the hospital setting. There's a focus on the productivity of nurses where you can actually calculate, okay, this is how much nursing time we expect we're going to need. This is how much nursing time we actually paid for in a given amount of time. We take the difference, and that's our productivity index. That's a measure of the productivity per unit of service or per patient visit that we're doing. So it's very much the application of a manufacturing model.
Right, from like car factories.
Exactly, from specifically for lean, specifically for Toyota.
Now, Parker, you looked at St. Mary's Hospital, I think, in Madison for the most part. How did this lean concept come into St. Mary's, and what does it look like on the hospital floor?
Well, nurses said that have been there a while when Sister Mary Jean, I think was her name, was walking the floor as a former CEO. They never heard anything about productivity. That wasn't a word really in the hospital's vocabulary. And then over the past maybe 10 years, but more recently in the past few years, these consultants have been brought in, and they brought with them a lot of focus on productivity. Among hospital executives, it's the most targeted goal to reduce the financial strains of their hospitals. So it's really in vogue right now is increasing productivity, specifically on labor.
And yeah, from the hospital perspective, labor is a big cost that they're trying to get control over, among some other costs. But labor is a big one, right? Is that the concept here?
Right. Labor can account for 40%, 50%, even more of a hospital's total expenditure. So it's a big target for hospitals to reduce their expenses for sure.
And nurses feel the pinch of that specifically because they tend to be the largest line item for labor in a given hospital.
And then you looked at a different hospital in particular, Bram, UW Health, also in Madison. How did lean make its way in there?
So UW Health nurses, they've been in the news quite a lot lately. You've talked about your show. Mm-hmm. They're trying to organize a union, and one of the main things that they're talking about is a similar concern to what St. Mary's nurses have about staffing levels. So just like at St. Mary's, UW Health has its own productivity tool where they're mapping out and tracking the productivity of a given unit. And that productivity measurement goes into decisions about, you know, how many nurses are on staff at, you know, at any given time within a unit. If the tool says there might be too many nurses there, a nurse might get sent home. But it also has to do with if, you know, a nurse retires or leaves for some reason, productivity can factor into whether that position will then be refilled later on.
Now, let's find out what this looks like from the perspective of the nurse and the patients that he or she deals with. What does this mean for, if I'm a nurse, how many patients I might be working with, how much time I spend with them? What did you see, Parker?
Well, nurses at St. Mary's are definitely under a lot of strain. They say they're very burned out. They go home. They can barely even eat. They have way too many patients, they say, and especially inexperienced nurses who are the ones that fill in for the veteran nurses who are really the backbone of providing a lot of guidance and just expertise that you can't learn in school, the stuff that comes from years of experience. They're leaving because of these benefit changes, and the people filling those positions are often inexperienced nurses. And they are tasked with having just as many patients as the experienced nurses. And they say that's a dangerous situation to be in. We heard of an anecdote about an inexperienced nurse having to take care of 6 patients overnight. And then this experienced nurse comes in the morning to take over her patients. And it turned out two of the patients had had strokes overnight and that had gone unnoticed. So a lot of this, the impact on patient care might not show up in data. We looked at Wisconsin Hospital Association data, and we didn't see any clear trends of increase in falls, for instance, which is a sign of short staffing. But talking with nurses, they say these conditions are getting worse, they're becoming more dangerous, and a lot of them had anecdotes to show how having more patients leads to more medical errors and leads to some adverse events.
Did you hear similar concerns at UW Health, Bram?
Yeah, that's right. And in terms of the actually seeing the trends changing in the hospital data, when we're speaking to experts on these things, they're saying it's unlikely you're going to see these kinds of changes at a given hospital over a short period of time. But when you take the large data, when you take a large view of multiple hospitals over a long period of time, the trend is very clear.
You focused on a couple of Madison hospitals. This is not just a Madison hospital story, right, Parker? This is something going on all over the country?
Right. There's strikes that have happened or are currently happening in a half dozen states in the past year alone over short staffing and the nurses and other staff feeling that the conditions are unsafe. A recent study showed that 70% of hospitals in the nation have adopted lean or some other form of efficiency optimizing sort of manufacturing model. A very much smaller percentage of those have maturely or widely implemented these models. But lean has really, you know, is in the vast majority of hospitals in the nation.
Talking to Parker Shore and Bram Sable-Smith about the reporting for Wisconsin Watch on the lean model, cutting labor costs at hospitals, the impact that can have on the job of the nurse and maybe the health of the patient. Bram, you, as part of this piece, talked to some experts who are, in some cases, advocates for the lean approach and the productivity numbers who said, yeah, but if you use them right, and they say hospitals may be using them wrong. What kind of things did you hear?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, lean in and of itself is not a bad thing. And it has had a lot of, you know, significantly good impacts in the healthcare industry. Hospitals around the country have used Lean to reduce the amount of time that patients are waiting to get into the ER, for example. They've used it to have a more efficient, intuitive process for, you know, stocking supplies. So Lean in and of itself, it's something that people really are advocating for. And you can kind of understand why it's taken off in hospitals around the country. But, you know, when you focus on one specific part of it, this is what the Lean advocates are saying. If there's an overemphasis on something like productivity, you know, at the expense of this overall approach, that can lead to this kind of labor tensions that we're talking about.
And Parker, some hospital departments don't know when their patients are coming. A delivery ward, for example, can't predict if 0, 1, or 5 women are going to show up to deliver. Is that a concern you heard raised?
Right. So a lot of these staffing levels are maybe fine in ideal circumstances, or if their models are go correctly and, you know, the amount of patients that the model thinks are going to come, and maybe then you have enough nurses at least, so it's not dangerous. But if there's an influx, like a bunch of mothers in labor suddenly showing up in a department, that might throw a wrench in things and really impact patient safety. So we heard an anecdote from 2 nurses in a recent hectic weekend in the labor and delivery unit where a woman was in labor and she was calling out for pain medication for an hour alone as her nurse was tending to another emergency. And we heard in other units where suddenly a nurse will have 2 highly acute patients, so people with serious medical challenges. And that would happen in the past, but in the past you had more nurses that could help on that. Now there's not a lot of wiggle room or flexibility to help out when sudden things happen like they often do in hospitals.
Bram, were you able to get a response from UW Health about these kind of concerns being raised?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at UW Health, they said this all started in 2017 with an initiative to save $80 million over the course of 18 months. UW Health exceeded that. They saved over $100 million. And a spokesperson said that their staffing is back to pre-2017 levels, that there's kind of some unique financial conditions in 2017 that were leading to the necessity for that kind of cost saving that included labor cuts. So they say that staffing is back to pre-2017 levels, but nurses say that these kind of staffing issues persist even with that.
And Parker, how about St. Mary's?
St. Mary's didn't really want to talk a ton for this article. They did say that they meet patient need across all units, across all ministries. They didn't really go into specifics about their procedures that ensure this. Their response was minimal.
And Bram, you were out in the field, I think, reporting this before COVID-19 became such a big news story. Was there any indication about how this maybe lack of slack in hospital capacity could impact the response to a sudden influx, a pandemic?
So this is an area we're reporting on right now, talking to nurses, going back, talking to some of our previous sources, talking to new sources about that. And it's absolutely on their mind. I think the way you described it, the lack of slack, really is, that's the big concern. That's what we're talking about, is kind of a rigidity, an inflexibility to respond to these kinds of influx events. At UW Health, you know, we're talking to nurses who just in the past few years, they've started getting these pages, these text messages from unit managers pleading for extra help. You know, we need a 6th nurse right now. Could that be you? Hey, we can buy you pizza, things like that. These kind of desperate messages asking for more staff. And that's within like the normal churn of circumstances. So as one nurse put it to me, this kind of staffing austerity and the pandemic together are not a good fit. And it's something that's on people's minds. Absolutely.
We'll watch for your future reporting on this. Bram, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Parker, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
That was Parker Shore, public affairs reporting fellow for the Cap Times, who is embedded with the Wisconsin Watch, and Bram Sable-Smith, the WPR Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow, also with Wisconsin Watch. You can read more of their reporting on staffing at hospitals at wisconsinwatch.org. Coming up, we'll get an update on how the COVID-19 outbreak is affecting sporting events in Wisconsin and beyond. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a bipartisan commission says the United States needs to do more to bulk up its cyber defenses. We'll talk with the co-chairs of that group about their recommendations. First, if we were living in normal times, many of us would be filling out our March Madness college basketball brackets. We would have found out yesterday, I think, who Wisconsin's teams would be playing and getting excited about that. But these aren't normal times. The NCAA canceled the men's and women's tournaments because of the COVID-19 outbreak. The Boys and Girls State High School basketball tournaments were also called off. And those hoping this would be the year for the Milwaukee Bucks to finally end their near 50-year NBA championship drought, COVID-19 is putting those dreams on hold as well. The virus is also pushing back the Milwaukee Brewers home opener and suspending play in the National Hockey League, professional golf, and other sports organizations. Megan Hart is Wisconsin Public Radio sports reporter. Megan, good to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Megan, it's got to be a weird time to be a sports reporter right now.
Yeah, it certainly does. Thursday, I would say last Thursday, was an incredibly hectic day, just covering all of these changes. I think for a while it looked like, we might have some sports taking place without fans in attendance, but it just really things have just changed so dramatically in the last week. And now I'm on the sports and COVID-19 beat, that's for sure.
Now, the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association, WIAA, they govern most high school sports in the state. As you mentioned, as of last Thursday, it looked like they were going to try to have the tournament still, but just a limited number of people in the audience. What led them ultimately to just cancel the tournaments altogether?
I think a lot of it has to do with, all of the uncertainty that we're facing. There's a lot of different guidelines, they said, coming at them from public health organizations that they were following. I went to a press conference they held Thursday to talk about the changes they made as far as limiting fans. And, they said that it's really kind of, they're making these decisions in real time as far as what the right thing to do is. And I guess it just got to a point where they didn't feel like it was safe to continue the girls' basketball tournament at all. They had started that on Thursday and then they discontinued it Friday. And the boys' tournament was supposed to be this weekend. And they've canceled that as well.
And that's not a decision I imagine they would take lightly. This is something they really don't want to do unless they absolutely have to. Did you get an impression of kind of the enormity of their thinking on this?
Yeah, I will say that their executive director, Dave Anderson, at the press conference, you could tell that he was really wrestling with the decision that, like so many people in the sports world, he really felt for especially seniors and their coaches after they've been training for years for some of these state tournaments. So it was definitely not a decision that they made lightly, but it seems to be that they kind of fell into step with the rest of what the sports world is doing as far as suspending or canceling competition.
Have you gotten a sense of the reactions out there in the high school sports world since they made that decision?
I think, a lot of people are disappointed at the situation, but as from what I can tell, people I've spoken to seem to understand the reasoning. They understood why it was canceled. One thing that the executive director of WIA did say at that press conference is that he kind of regretted that it all had to be decided so abruptly because mm-hmm. he knew Thursday morning there were fans that had already driven into Green Bay for the girls tournament that weren't going to be able to attend the games. And then they ultimately ended up being canceled. But I think, people have to be understanding with everything that's going on right now.
Before we move on from the high school level, spring sports, I know, having young athletes in my own household, they're getting ready to have tryouts for some of the teams. What are you watching for to see if seasons start, when seasons start, if they happen at all?
Well, WIA did send out a press release yesterday saying that spring sports seasons are suspended until further notice. I know a lot of little leagues and youth sports are also on hold at the moment. So it's really hard. I'm sure if you ask me again tomorrow, mm-hmm. I'll have something different to tell you. So we're following it as closely as we can.
Talking to Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio sports reporter, about the widespread closings and ends of seasons, or at least postponements of seasons, because of the COVID-19 virus. Let's move up to the college level. No NCAA tournaments, men's or women. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I think so many people are looking forward to March Madness this time of year. I know that I'm based in Green Bay, but we did have some reporters go out and talk to students last week, and a lot of them brought up sports and said how, that was one of kind of the big disappointments, is that they're not going to get to watch Wisconsin men's basketball, which has had a really good run recently. Same with Wisconsin women's hockey, was also in the midst of the NCAA tournament. So, it's I think, again, you know, people, a lot of people are sad about it. But again, I think that the general feeling in the sports world is that this is the right thing to do.
Right. Can you talk about the economic impact? We can roll professional sports into this as well. Obviously, there are a lot of other big economic problems going on. But these are even the high school tournaments for Madison and Green Bay. They're big deals. The pro teams, the NCAA. This is a big economic hit, isn't it?
It is huge. Yeah. I mean, you're right, at every single level. I think, of course, one of the big things that that everyone is looking at right now is whether or not the Olympics are going to be able to go forward. The president of the International Olympic Committee last week, he encouraged athletes to continue preparation with great confidence and full steam. But Tokyo spent an estimated $26 billion preparing for these Olympics. So just that alone will have huge economic impacts if that's canceled all over the world. I know a lot of, I think one of the kind of bright spots recently has been athletes stepping up and making donations to arena workers, which the Bucks, everyone on the Milwaukee Bucks roster did that, and the team actually chose to match that. So there is a fund to help pay workers at the Pfizer Forum, hourly workers who won't be able to work during this NBA suspension. I know J.J. Watt is a former Badger and a football player from Wisconsin. He and his wife have donated $350,000 to provide meals to people in Houston, where he plays for the Houston Texans. But a lot of people are impacted by this, of course, in the sports world and outside of it.
Now, the Bucks, you mentioned, they've had this fantastic season. They've been the biggest story in Wisconsin sports over the last couple of months. What do we know about whether play could resume in the NBA? What are they looking at there?
Yeah, at the point where the season was suspended, the Bucks were leading the NBA. They are, there's still a lot of questions, but the NBA has been looking at arena availability through August, indicating, that they want to continue the season, but it's unlikely to happen anytime soon. Of course, the CDC issued guidelines last night advising that all events with over 50 people be canceled through the middle of May. So it would likely not resume before then. And there's a lot of challenges because, of course, these NBA arenas often host concerts or NHL teams or all different kinds of events. So that makes scheduling challenging. But I know that that they're optimistic that they can continue the season.
And finally, baseball made some of the newest news. So what are they looking at now for pushing back opening day?
Yeah, that one really breaks my heart. So last week, they did decide to suspend spring training, and they said that the season would be delayed by at least 2 weeks. But today, Major League Baseball, the owners and the commissioner made an announcement that they are pushing back the opening day. Again, they didn't give a timeline. They did say that they're committed to playing as many games as possible this season, and they said that they would keep fans up to date as the schedule sort of comes together moving forward. They will need about a month of preparation because spring training is on hold, so it will take a while before the season can start.
And briefly, Megan, what are you watching for next? Are there any other shoes you're waiting to drop when it comes to sports and COVID-19?
I think that the Olympics is a big thing. The Ryder Cup is scheduled to take place in Wisconsin in September, and that will have a huge economic impact on the state. So I think we're kind of waiting to see what will happen with that. But for sports fans who, it's not quite as satisfying probably as watching live sports. NFL free agency started today. So the Packers have closed operations for 2 weeks at Lambeau Field, but they are already at work kind of putting together next year's team. And the NFL draft is still going to take place in April without fans in attendance. But at least that'll give sports fans something to talk about.
Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Megan Hart is Wisconsin Public Radio sports reporter. We talked with her about how the COVID-19 outbreak has been affecting sporting events in Wisconsin. Basically canceling all of them. Some seasons shut down, others postponed. The NBA, Major League Baseball, and NHL are saying their seasons may resume, but only time will tell. High school and college basketball appear to be done for the season. Let us know how this affects you. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. We're talking a lot about the COVID-19 illness here on the Ideas Network, and we're going to keep on doing that. But we're also going to take some breaks and talk about other things, hopefully, that are fun and interesting along the way. We have a couple good ones lined up for you tomorrow. Let's start tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest are going to talk about dinosaurs. I know, you know, we like talking about science here on the Ideas Network, and I know you, at least when we hear from you, you like to hear science stories too. Well, dinosaurs, we're going to hear about things we're learning from dinosaur eggshells that are fossilized from 75 million years ago. Kate gave me some of the inside scoop on this one. Turns out we can learn a lot from these eggshells, including why many dinosaurs, this is kind of blowing my mind, may have been warm-blooded. I thought reptiles, cold-blooded, right? No, a lot of them are warm-blooded, apparently. Some of them grew feathers, that I'd heard. And this could give us insight on how birds evolved from dinosaurs. So check that out on the morning show. Nice change of pace, so hearing about early dinosaur prehistory. Then on the Larry Miller Show, get some info on filing your taxes. Okay, maybe that's not as fun as dinosaurs, but it sounds pretty useful. And hey, on Central Time, we're going to bring you some fun stuff amid the serious stuff as well. Let us know what you want to hear about. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.